Hello and welcome to Brown Game Strong Season 2. I have literally been waiting and so excited to share this with you for the past 3 months, which is how long I've been working for it now. My millennial ass just couldn't deal with working for so long in silence without actually telling anyone. So I'm glad the time is here and it's now and ready to share everything with you. So over the past 3 months, I've overcome a lot of self-doubt. Can I really do this by myself? I have had such interesting conversations over FaceTime, which have lasted well over an hour, each one, literally every single one. And I've connected with people that I knew and people that I didn't necessarily know, but reached out to like a creep on Instagram, because that's what we do nowadays. And I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to connect with these individuals, and I'm so grateful that I'm able to bring these conversations to you. So I really hope you enjoy them. And my biggest hope for this season is that in every single episode, you're able to take away some sort of nugget of inspiration, of motivation, or of just comfort, because that's what the essence of Brown Game Strong has always been, to just remind ourselves that we're not alone in our experiences and our thoughts. So, you know, if there is something that you want to achieve with your life and there's something that you really want to do, but you're struggling, you're procrastinating, you're not sure how to start, hopefully these conversations will help you get through that with a touch of representation, of course. I'm not going to ramble for too long. Let's introduce our very first guest. I am so excited to share this with you. His name is Pranav Patel and he is a law student. He is an ex-NASA intern, which is sick. I don't know how many degrees he has. And he is the co-founder of Afrodesi, which if you are a dancer in the South Asian community, specifically in the diaspora, chances are very high that you've probably heard of them. Afrodesi is a dance company that fuses African and Indian dance styles in such a sick and creative way, can I just add, because their routines are awesome. I've taken a bunch of their classes now in person and online, and they are working really hard. And at the same time, they're managing entire lives outside of dance as well. Pranav and I met in London when he came to teach a workshop. This was late last year in 2019. And what I think really stuck with me after chatting to him was how no bullshit he was, how just straight up he was, and also how much tenacity he had to just go for the things that he commits to and that he kind of sets himself up for. And that's something that I take a lot of inspiration from. There's so much to unpack. And, you know, we go from talking about his little puppy that he got in lockdown, which, I'll be honest, is the only reason I really invited him. And he talks about co-founding Afrodesi, of course, and his journey throughout university, growing up as a good little Guju boy. Also about his opinions on the Black Lives Matter movement, which is something that he's been quite vocal about on social media. And you can tell that it's very close to his heart. So it's a bit of a mishmash, but I hope that you enjoy it. And yeah, without further ado, let's get cracking. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Really good. Thank you so much for coming on as a guest. How has it been? How's your week been so far?
Well, my week's been pretty exciting for me, actually, because I just started my second year of law school. So this is the first week. So just settling into classes, sort of still getting my textbooks, which is, I guess, not a good thing. And also moving into my new place in Gainesville. So I just switched apartments. So it's been pretty busy, but I'm finally settled in and ready to go for the next 12 weeks. So exciting stuff, yeah.
Are you usually quite adaptable to change, or is this quite a big change for you?
I think in my life, I've always been very, I want to say nonchalant towards things that cause big changes in my life. For instance, I had to move out of my apartment at the end of July suddenly because of the breed of dog that I have and new management, and someone showed up to my door, the property manager, and they said, sorry, you have to leave within 8 hours. And it was like 11 a.m. and it was a work day. And they said, you have to be out by 7. and I just closed my eyes for a little bit, and I meditate a lot. And I sat there for 5 minutes. I gathered my thoughts on how I'm going to be able to do it, including, you know, renting a truck to move, renting a moving space, like a public storage unit to move all my stuff into, and what my next steps would be. I mean, I think I get a lot of that from my parents, because I called my mom right after. I said, okay, look, this is the situation. And I think my parents' immediate reaction, knowing me and knowing how I handle things, were just like, look, things like this in life happen. Just relax, take a deep breath. You have 8 hours. Be calculated and make the change that you need to, you know, versus lecturing me, which would have really, you know, kind of stressed me out. So I think my parents kind of get that about me too. And that day went great. You know, I had two friends help and I moved, and I spent a week up in New Jersey, came back and moved into my new place. That's kind of a telling story about me in a lot of ways. I just, if there's something bad that happens in life, I think I just try to be collected about it. And the same thing about good things in life. It's kind of just adapt to the situation.
Yeah, not try to go to extremes. I think I'm a bit similar in that way. Like, I can't imagine what it would feel like to be given like 8 hours notice, but I'd probably call my mom as well, panicking and be like, okay, what do I do? So what, like, where did you move to? Did you have a place sorted out?
Yeah, I did have a place sorted out. The reason why I had to suddenly move out was because there was no form for a formal lease extension signed on in my previous place. They had just emailed me saying, hey, it's okay if you stay here until August 7th, which was when I was supposed to move into my new place. Here's the rent that you'll pay, all of that from the leasing agent. But then they never filed the paperwork for it. The onus was on them to do it, but they didn't. And the property manager didn't know that it was just informalized in an email. And the leasing agent was supposed to prepare a form. I had even asked whether there was a form I needed to sign. She had said no, but I guess I needed the form, you know. And in that moment, I could have thought about the legalities of it and thinking about fighting it. But, you know, having studied some law and basics of property law that I know, I think the best move was to just comply, move out, and then think about whether I wanted to go back and seek any sort of damages or anything like that. You know, in the moment, the right move was just to figure out what to do for those 9 days.
You definitely did the right thing, thinking about just sorting yourself out before kind of worrying about those things. So how, aside from this sudden move you had to make, how has like COVID been for you, and how's 2020 treating you?
So 2020 is definitely, I think, for many of us, going to be the most memorable year of our lives, at least for a long while. And I think there's a lot of negatives that come with it. Obviously, starting back from January, from Mamba dying and him being a great idol of mine, and me being sort of kind of lost in that. I still remember, I feel like the world stopped that day. And then within months, you know, within just 2 months, we had a global pandemic and killer hornets on the West Coast, and half of Australia was on fire. You know, it seemed like the world was really ending. But in a lot of ways, you know, my job hunt wasn't going well. So by March or so, I had felt, you know, this might be the worst year ever. Classes had gone to pass fail. Afrodaisy was right on the brink of going to 3 different countries, and I didn't know whether Akash had a job. So we were constantly talking about that to make sure that we had some sort of, you know, first he had security before we thought about what we were going to do. So all of those things. But then I think starting March, actually, when the pandemic started, I'm thankful for a lot of what's come out of it. You know, shortly after the pandemic started, I wasn't doing well in the job hunt because I was a first year law student. It's pretty hard in the States to get a firm job, especially in light of a pandemic. And then I had NASA just give me the opportunity of a lifetime. Probably one of the happiest moments of my life was getting that email. And I still remember running around the street, just screaming, you know, full of joy and just fist pumping. And I was just so happy, you know, something I dreamed of my entire life finally came through. And that experience was amazing. I rose to 3 leadership positions in my law school. So I really took on a lot of responsibility more than I had ever had before. Now I'm in a way better apartment than I had ever been. Being by myself also allowed me the opportunity to get a dog who I love, and I love spending time with her. It's kind of really transformed me as a person in terms of being more responsible, kind of like, you know, full dad mode in a lot of ways. And I think it's been really nice. I've gotten to travel, you know, a month, you know, in next week, I'm going to spend 1 month in some part of the United States. We're finalizing it today with a few friends and just stay in a house. It's going to be Seattle or Myrtle Beach or something like that, and have a house for a month because we're all remote so that we can live together. And kind of this is a unique opportunity to do that. So in a lot of ways, 2020 is also a peak, which is, you know, interesting. The Black Lives Matter movement that really got a lot of attention because of COVID. Hard to see that coming, but, you know, all the circumstances kind of aligned for that. This is also the year that, you know, not to get too political, but a new president hopefully will enter the office. So I think a lot of ways 2020 also has its positives and also a lot of negatives. And I think that that just sort of makes sense, right? I think years just kind of equalize and normalize through good and bad. And this is just an extreme example of it.
I don't know if you believe in yin and yang. I really do, like how every good has something bad and every bad has something good. But my first question to you is, what made you get a dog in lockdown?
First of all, that was very kind. Thank you. The dog decision, I think, was a bit abrupt. And I'm one of those people where I was always thinking about, you know, I wanted something. There's a tattoo that I've always wanted from an excerpt of a poem by Sir Rudyard Kipling, the poem If, and the dog was somewhere on there. And I have this little like bucket list of things that I like want to do in life, because I'm the type of guy that always wants to try everything. And part of my list was owning a dog and raising a dog and having a companion. And COVID happened and I found myself alone in my apartment, not socializing with people. And I thought that this was just the right opportunity. And honestly, I didn't wake up that morning thinking I was going to get a dog, but I'm very quick. Once I make up my mind on something, I just do it. I don't really wait. So I sent a few applications out. One person got back immediately and they said, look, we have this really well-behaved pit bull mix. You know, she's a puppy and we just can't take care of her anymore. So we need to give her up for adoption because we're expecting another child. Would you like to meet her to see if it's a good fit? And I was like, absolutely. And I drove like 40 minutes. We met halfway between our homes. I met her and immediately she was just the sweetest dog ever. She put all her weight on me and then told me that, you know, she trusted me. And I was like, I was sold immediately. And I was like, okay, like you're my dog now. And that morning, I had no idea that I would be owning a dog. You know, it was 0 to 100 real quick, but I never looked back and it never occurred to me that, like, you know, oh my God, I've made such a big commitment in my life. It was more so just, I was just happy. I was happy to do it, happier to have her in my life. And now I'm just good, happy to have a friend. You know, yeah, she's an awesome dog. So, and like I said, it teaches you so much. You know, I read books on it, and I love that she's a pit bull even more because of all the restrictions on her. It just makes me love her more, knowing that she can't travel to so many countries and states and can't take her on an airplane just makes me, you know, want to be an advocate for her breed, and has made me realize that it's not really the dog. It's always about the owner. You know, you can always raise a dog to do what you want it to do for the most part, because they're our companions. They want to be there for us and they want to make us proud, kind of almost as a species. But if you give them that trust and you have a you establish mutual trust between you, that relationship is phenomenal. So yeah,
absolutely. Now I think pit bulls are probably among the most misunderstood breed. I just love seeing your relationship with her. It's just really cute. And I think I'm actually so inspired by that myself, because I've wanted a dog for 26 years of my life, literally. And having dissy parents, it's always just like, oh, but who's going to look after it? And like, they can bite you and stuff. And it's just whole like misconception from, you know, whenever we go back to India and like, you know, there's stray dogs on the street. And I think there is that perception of dogs are not something that every Indian household really wants to have. I think with my parents, it was literally just, we don't want the responsibility. Like when you can afford one, when you can look after one, just get one yourself.
Yeah, that's I had the same lectures growing up about having a dog. And parents were farmers, or my dad was a farmer rather. And so they had dogs, but, you know, used for herding and for other purposes. So they didn't really view dogs as companions, more so as or wild animals that they can tame to do certain tasks. So it's just a different outlook on pets, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, more power to our generation to.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you're definitely like setting a good example. And my second point around lockdown was, what made you dye your hair pink? Because I've seen photos. I don't know if it's pink right now or if it's blonde.
I don't know. Again, that's one of those decisions that wasn't really, I didn't even know that was on my bucket list. I always like playing with my hair. I like trying different things. There was a phase in my life just 2 years ago where I was like, you know, in my professional life, I'm probably not going to have longer hair. So I just decided one day that I'm just going to have longer hair, and I grew it out for like 16 months and I had like shoulder length hair. And this wasn't too much before we met. And I rocked the bun for like a good year. And it was fun, you know, like it was low maintenance. I liked having it. I always wondered what it was like to have longer hair. So I did that. And similarly, in the same vein, this year, I was just like, you know, Akash, who I guess I'll talk about in a little bit here, but he lost a bet and he had to dye his hair because of it. And him and a few of my other friends, they all kind of lost. They all had to change their hair color or shave or something. And I heard about it and they all looked kind of ridiculous. It made me laugh, but at the same time, it was like, well, now they get to see themselves in a different light. Let me try. You know, I'm in self-quarantine. And so I did it and I tried just to see. And I wanted to do it myself because I didn't want to pay someone $200 to run an experiment on my head. So I researched it, did it myself. And honestly, I'm done with it. Yeah, I actually bought hair dye yesterday to go back black because I do have to take my photos. I have to be class all the time. So by the end of this podcast, I'm probably gonna apply some black hair dye because I just can't wait for it to all grow back.
It's good to try things. And I love that you're just like, one day you'll just wake up and be like, I want to do this. I didn't even know it was on my bucket list, but I'm just gonna go and do it anyway.
Yeah,
that's really cool. But also because we're in lockdown, you're not really gonna meet anyone anyway,
and also you don't want to be around those people that are gonna judge you for stuff like that, you know. I don't really.
Yeah. How do you feel about piercings?
I think 17 days ago now, I was in Jersey and all my friends have a piercing or both ears pierced. I guess it's more of a cultural thing to some degree. Mm. But I'd always wondered and I was always like, ah, it's not professional. You know, I want to run for political office one day. Maybe getting a piercing is a horrible idea. But then now we're in 2020 and the world is as accepting as it's ever been, even more so of just everyone, you know, of all colors and sexualities and ethnicities. So I was like, okay, the world isn't what it used to be and what my parents wanted it to be. I can try one of these two things. And so literally I didn't know that I was going to get it that morning. And then I went to the mall and I went right after a 10-year-old girl at Claire's, which is where everyone gets a piercing. And I went right after her, talked to her through the whole process. Yeah, no, and I got my ears pierced. And so I'm recovering from that. And I think that kind of fulfilled my little itch for like bad boy syndrome just a little bit, you know. So I think that the tattoo will wait. But yeah, who knows? I might just wake up one day and get one. So, yeah.
I feel like most brown guys got piercings at like 16. I feel like that was such a 10 years ago type of thing that you're living your like fantasies of being
blonde hair piercings. I'm like living the whole in sync like 1990s right now. So
I mean, yeah, if anything this year has taught us, it's just do whatever you want because you just don't know. Like nothing makes sense. We might as well just embrace whatever we want to do. Okay, so we are going to go into maybe slightly more serious questions. So what was your upbringing like? Where did you grow up? And did you have like other South Asians around you in school?
Yeah, so I grew up in New Jersey, North Jersey. So a little bit further from Indian Central, which is like Edison and Jersey City. It's kind of like a white suburb. I had probably like 10 or 15 Indians in each of my classes. Culturally, I think my upbringing wasn't really affected much by my interactions at school as much as it was by how my parents decided to raise me. My parents raised me sort of an ideal brown child in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, my first language was Gujarati, so they taught me how to read and write that. They taught me how to read and write Hindi and speak it. I used to do all my times tables in Gujarati, recite my alphabets. They taught me the Bhagavad Gita. I think at some point like 12 of the 18 chapters memorized. I still know quite a few of them. I knew all the prayers. I knew the meanings of the scriptures. They taught me some Sanskrit. And then English was just something that I picked up in school, right? They didn't really bother with English. They were like, you know, you're going to go to school. You'll figure it out. You're a smart kid. And so they've been kind of laissez-faire with me in school always. And I think that they just supplemented my life outside of school a lot with activities. So being an only child, I think, definitely helps with that. I was kind of like a miracle baby for my parents. So I think maybe that even like strengthens the bond between us. But, you know, whatever I wanted to do in life, they always provided me a way to do it. I played tabla my whole life, like tennis since I was 4 years old, you know, golf lessons and just whatever it was, playing saxophone just to balance out the musical side of it, doing tutoring in Kumon, which everyone did at our age, stuff like that. So that really kind of was my foundation. And I think that that's ultimately what kind of shaped my educational career and my interactions with people. Honestly, you know, I didn't have too many brown friends growing up. I had them through Sunday school. But other than that, in school, I think I was just open to everyone. Most of my friends were, you know, Asian, white. And I think we had great relationships. Fortunately for me, I came from a town where I was maybe only bullied like twice and like nothing serious, nothing physical, just, you know, teasing and infected me a little bit, you know. The only time it really affected me was when someone said something about my mom and the bindi or something. I don't remember the specifics of it, but I was really young. I remember getting really upset. But other than that, not really. I didn't feel marginalized because I was Indian. Mm-hmm. I think I'm very adaptable. I like to just kind of like recognize someone's culture and kind of adapt so that they don't feel like this divide between us. Now I'm in Southern United States of America at Southern Hospitality, you know, the whole stereotypes about like the rednecks and like the whole thing. And like a lot of my friends here are like very staunch Republicans and very conservative. And some parts of me are definitely conservative and others aren't. But my point is, these aren't people that I would have ever associated with before or not having gone to law school. And now they're some of my best friends. So, you know, you look past your differences and you kind of just work on your similarities and build relationships that way.
Yeah, I think being an only child, I think I have had probably a slightly different experience to you with like being a lot more indoorsy. Like I didn't really do loads of things as a kid. but in terms of adaptability, I think you made a really good point about how like you would adapt yourself around the people, you know, who are near you. And that I think is a very common trait that we have sometimes as ethnic minorities, because we find ourselves almost like trying to make the other person comfortable and like almost not, I don't know if the right word is threatened, but just not like uncomfortable by our, you know, different culture. And so did you ever find yourself trying to almost suppress your Indianness? Like you mentioned about the bindi thing, like, did you ever feel almost like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, keep that at home and then not really talk about my culture too much with my friends?
I wouldn't really say that. The only time maybe I was conscious about it, because my mom used to always dress me for grade school. So I'd always have the in shirt and the tail in my wad, you know what I mean? So I'm like, you know, and I remember like getting a little made fun of for that, not just by my peers, but sometimes by my teachers. They were like, why is your hair so oily? You know, why are you so formal? And like, eventually I went to my mom and I was like, Mom, I can't walk in with like a proper slacks and a shirt tucked in when I'm 8 years old. It's just not going to work, you know, that's going to really cause problems later in life. So I'd appreciate it if I can not do that, you know. Other than that, I never felt like that. You know, if someone was curious about my culture, I definitely tell them. I don't hide the ball. And I think as people get to know me, they get to know it. But I think you're right. I think that we're in a unique position being immigrants, and especially coming from such a rich culture. When you contrast that with Western culture, we're in that unique position where we sort of understand both, right? We're raised in the West, but we have the cultural values of the East. And so we're more hashtag cultured in a lot of ways than a lot of people. And in that, it kind of affects my interactions with people, because, you know, at first, you know, I'm not going to like throw my culture at them. I'll kind of wait to see how they're reactive to certain things. And I definitely think I subconsciously am cognizant of it and kind of adjust my behavior, but never in a way that's hard on myself for being Indian. Yeah. I think I'm very proud to be Indian, and I'm very proud of my culture. So someone asks, you know, I'll definitely slip it in.
I think you've approached that in such a positive way. And your comment about the fact that we are in a very unique position is so true. I think the world is kind of almost moving in that direction now where, you know, there aren't such hard-coded boundaries. It's very blurry. And yeah, we're from all over the place. So like if someone asks you where you're from, it's nice because it like sparks up a conversation because like, you know, you can be like, oh yeah, but my parents are from here, but then I grew up there and now I live here. So
yeah
apart from the tail in your hair, which I can imagine the trauma. It's funny because like our parents obviously want the best for us, right? But like they probably sometimes just don't understand what you're going through maybe in school.
Yeah And I was just talking about there was a deep conversation that I was having with one of my Indian friends on video the other day, but you know, it was about like how parents can be so close-minded sometimes, or that's what she was complaining to me about. It was like, you know, my parents are always talking about marriage, I need to get married, and they just don't seem to get the cultural kind of, you know, what is Western culture. They don't get dating culture, they don't get why I would want to lead my own life. They seem to micromanage everything. You know, when I broke up with my significant other, they immediately wanted to set me up with someone else, you know, things like that. And she was kind of annoyed by how her parents reacted to it. But if you really kind of contextualize it, you think about what our parents have done in their generation as immigrants from the life that they knew. So they, you know, they grew up pretty much in villages or, you know, even small cities in India, and they did their education. And coming here, most, you know, for many, it was like the late 70s, it was the 80s. And on the backdrop of it all, you have a basically the largest industrial revolution the world has ever seen that they are now going through at the same time. And they're seeing it. They're seeing India go from a young country to kind of a middle-aged country and develop at the rate that it's developing. And they're kind of fixated and they're kind of like stuck in time with their cultural values that they had when they were in India, not fully being cognizant of how India too has changed so much. And they're just here trying to do the best in a foreign country for their children. In a lot of ways, they will always have your best interest in mind, but they do what they know to do and they try to provide for you. And when you try to think about it like that, then it sort of like takes away that anger and resentment that you have toward them. And it makes you appreciate what they've done for you because they do have your best interest in mind. They just know their cultural values, and their cultural values are a bit different than ours, but they're trying their best to kind of work with both of them. So absolutely, all power to them, right? We couldn't have the lives that we have without them. We owe everything to their generation and the opportunities that we have. So it's a different perspective. And I think it helped my friend at that time kind of just be less angry with how her parents kind of reacted and be more understanding of where they might be coming from. So
it's so important to think about like their struggles and their experiences as well, because I just can't imagine like what it's like to go from one culture, which is so like collectivist, you know, it's completely different to the way, you know, things are done in the West, and to go straight into like America or Europe, where like it's very individualistic and they probably like don't speak the language that fluently, and they're having to learn everything from scratch and find a way to, you know, make enough money to sustain themselves and provide a future for their kids. Also provide like a life of comfort for their kids maybe, which is something that they didn't experience having moved and having experienced so much discomfort. So there was actually a really nice poem by Rupi Kaur which talks about this and how like specifically around accents. So you know how with our parents sometimes we, especially as kids, like sometimes it's really easy to be embarrassed of your parents' English accent because it's like, oh, what, you know, why do you speak like this? Like all my friends, their parents speak like so fluently, or, you know, just not understanding like the context of the situation. And her poem, I can't remember the name of it, but she just talks about how like that accent is like laden with everything that they've gone through. Can you even imagine what it's been like? And you need to be proud of that. You need to wear it like a crown, something like that, like very cheesy. But I started seeing it very differently after that point, because at home we speak Hindi, we don't speak English. And yeah, and it's just like, it's something that I embrace so much, like knowing that I grew up speaking Hindi and like I can speak that fluently, but obviously learning English in school and being able to speak that as well.
And be proud of them, you know, to your point, wear it like a crown or whatever you want to say. I mean, really, we owe it to their generation. It definitely takes a long time for us to realize that. I think more and more, like as you age, you start to realize these sort of nuanced things about life and gain some wisdom about it. But it's definitely shaped how I interact with my parents now than what I did before, you know? And I think it's all positive. So,
and then moving on to kind of from your childhood onto university, how did your experience then change when you moved to uni or college?
My parents, you know, had kind of pushed me to the point where I had finished calculus before I finished, like entered high school. That's where I was. And I was taking buses from my middle school to my high school so that I could take advanced courses while I was like a sixth grader with all the 10th graders and 11th graders. So I was that kid. And so school Indian. Came so easy. Yeah, like so Indian. Like I broke my school's records for the amount of AP exams taken. And like I was the best debater in the state. And I was without effort, mind you. Like I was doing three sports and coming home every day at 7 p.m. and playing video games and just waking up at 4 in the morning. You know, my parents thought that I was like possessed. I would wake up at 4 in the morning, read for 3 hours and go to school. I had that drive, but like not really the work ethic. It was kind of just this procrastinating, like everything's easy for me. I was definitely way too arrogant at certain points in high school, you know, like in my whole senior year, I never once took a backpack to school. I used to just have a pencil and like a neck pillow so that I could like rest my head while the teacher was talking. And I was that like arrogant child, and like they hated me for it. I remember this one physics professor was like, he hated me so much because he was just like, you know, like you need to be more active in class. Like it doesn't matter whether you know what you're doing. Like, you know, all these really, really valid points. But he had said, and he was just like, you know, if you don't do any assignments, but the rule in my school was if you took a college level course and you got a 5 on the AP exam, the grade that the teacher can give you is an A-. And so I just did none of the work for that class, none of the assignments. I was an absolute 0%. I was going to get a complete fail in that class. No participation grade. I was dead last in the class. But like, I knew that if I just got a 5 on the exam, he had to give me an A-. And he hated it. And he knew that was happening. And he probably prayed when we took the exam that I didn't get it. But I got it, and it was in my sleep I got it, you know. And I walked up to him and I had him sign the form that gave me an A-, and he just resented me for it. And I know I was a horrible student because I was smart, but I wasn't respectful, first of all. And it wasn't to kind of showboat. It was just like, I don't need to do these assignments. I already know this. This is a waste of my time sort of thing. I want to focus on other stuff. Fast forward to college, and college just slaps me in the face, right? You know, you go to college, and I went to Northwestern, so good school, right, obviously, and everyone's top of their class. Every one of my friends that I made, you know, I remember talking to orientation to people, and they're like, you know, where were you in your class? Like, I was valedictorian. And that was just what everyone said. Everyone is valedictorian. Everyone was top of their class. Everyone had perfect SAT scores. So you're thrown into this, and I love this analogy. I always use it. It's like you're in a pond your whole life. You're around your little groups of fish, and college is a lake, right? It's so much bigger than that pond. And now you're like, oh my God, class is optional, right? You're not failing if you don't go to all these classes. Like our professors didn't care whether you didn't go to class. They were just like, you know, you're just going to fail if you don't go to class. And they were right, right? But having that option and having no work ethic established kind of just ruined my first year of college. You know, it just slapped me in the face. You know, I got B's and I was like, what is a B? You know, like, like, you know, and like, I was shook. And it took a long time to establish that work ethic. You know, I spread myself too thin. I was like, I'm going to dance now. I started dancing because I had a crush on a girl. But, you know, I joined a fraternity, convincing my parents that being in a fraternity would be an amazing thing because a president, I think, of the United States was in my fraternity. And so, you know, I used that to my advantage and kind of convinced my parents to let me do that. So kind of just, I got thrown in the deep end. And I saw my friends who did. There's two types of valedictorian kids. You know, there's the ones that are like me who don't have a work ethic established. And then there's the ones that got there because of hard work. And what I realized is that hard work trumps talent, trumps natural inclinations for anything, any day. Hard work wins. And college was a hard reminder of that. And unfortunately, I didn't realize that after college. I realized that toward the end of my college. But, you know, I was able to show that upward trend. And that gave me some opportunities for grad school and stuff like that. So I was able to, it wasn't too late. But that's what college was all about, to be honest. in a lot of ways, it was also connecting with my South Asian community a lot. I mean, part of the Desi dance circuit in America is gigantic. I didn't even know. I'd never danced in my life before college, before my sophomore year of college. But I was at an after party supporting my buddy who was on the dance team, and they were down a guy and they were competing 1 week later in San Francisco. The captain came up to me and I was kind of just dancing and moving around to like some hip hop music in the party. And he was like, "You look like you can move, you know, do you want to be on a dance team? I know you like that girl." And I was like, okay, you know, but that took over my life, right? Like a week later, I performed in like UC Berkeley on their like huge theater. And it turns out that was also the first and last stage that I ever competed on. So that was kind of a full circle thing. But yeah, I was sold. But then that just took over my time, you know, I put everything into it. You know, 1 year later, I was kind of on the executive board of that team and we were making a run for the national championship. It just took over. And so even that kind of put school on the side. So that's what college was all about. And I think ever since college, it's a whole new chapter of my life, which is grad school and everything that I've accomplished since college. I'm very proud of how I finally established my work ethic and learned to actually harness my talents, and also humbled myself a lot more and thought of myself a lot in relation to all the wonderful people that are out there. So I think college was really positive, even though I didn't approach it right.
Oh my God, I have so many opinions. Firstly, I'm so glad we weren't friends in school. I would have fucking hated you because I was the kid who always did her homework and like got A's, and like my mom would always be like, "Do your maths homework." Like that was the thing. You had to be good at maths. The whole idea about like not having work ethic, do you think that a part of you still is that person that it feels a little lazy sometimes and you really have to push yourself? Do you procrastinate?
I procrastinate all the time, but I think I'm more effective about procrastinating. So, you know, I won't procrastinate like at 4 a.m. when there's a 9 a.m. assignment. You know, I'll procrastinate like the full day before. But I have my if we talk about like balance in life, I think that's when it really comes into play, because on paper, honestly, I look like a crazy person. I look like a demonic person. And whenever I talk to people, they're like, no, that can't be your life. You're not doing this many things at once. And also asking us if you want to relax and chill on Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays because you have them off. You're not that person. No. And I think you have a certain amount of energy in your day and a certain amount of time. But I think if you just allocate just enough effort into everything that you want to do, I believe that everyone could see that there's so much that you can do in any given day and all at once, even as long as you don't kind of get exhausted by the moment and the panic of that, of the burden that's placed on you. I think that you can do a lot. And so I kind of just throw little pockets of energy into like little ventures that I'm part of or little roles that I'm part of when I feel like it's kind of slacking a little bit. And I think that keeps me afloat. So to that regard, yes, there's a little bit of laziness that's still in me. I'm still working on it. But law school has been huge because, you know, law school's not like undergrad. It's way tougher. And especially for a STEM kid in law school, where there's so much history and reading and critical thinking about, like, it's a whole different type of thinking, right, than like the STEM and science fields. That like all my peers are like history majors and literature majors, and they know how to quote Shakespeare's whatever, like, you know. And I have no idea. So law school kind of just forced me to really get my shit together, for lack of a better word. Yeah.
You do know that they say that the laziest people are actually the most successful sometimes, because they find creative ways to get shit done, basically, which is what you're doing. We're all going to go stalk your LinkedIn after this podcast just to confirm how much stuff you do. But I think you can really spin it. Like, you can, yes, on one hand, like you can be almost seen as someone who does too much and like almost tries to push himself too much. Or you could try and like spin it into a story where you're like, actually, I balance stuff. And like, I have a lot of respect for people who are able to balance lots of things. And like having a corporate job and like doing lots of different things like dance and running this podcast and stuff like that. Sometimes people do ask me like, how do you do it all? They don't know that like I spend hours just lying on my bed, like doing nothing. Literally. It's just, you know, it's a trait of a lazy person. Like, we just get up and get shit done in like an hour and then we go back to napping. what was your journey like with dance? You said you had a crush on someone and that's how you got into it. What was it like going into Afrodisi straight after that?
Yeah, that's dance has been a wild journey to me. And honestly, there's so many life lessons that I've gotten out of it. I'm so happy that I decided to do that. It's such a big passion in my life. Yeah, starting with Anubhav, that I was part of, you know, first year, it was kind of just kind of learning the baby steps. But the second year I took on part of the show that you watched, the coming out theme. I was one of the 5 board members who put that show together. That was just a phenomenal experience. That kind of just launched me into wanting a lot more out of dance, especially because we saw a lot of success that year. We got to have a really big impact on the circuit, which I think is still felt today because people's costumes changed. We changed the narrative. We were the first team to take like all those glittery, shimmery costumes and turn it into outfits that you'd see in day to day. Like we wore jeans and blazers and dresses and did contemporary segments and did things that were a lot different than what the norm was. So the team really transitioned from being what we call ourselves a Hindi film dance team to a fusion team in that one year. And we also tackled a very serious theme, but in a lighthearted way. And rest assured, I mean, for the next, you know, 6 years, the circuit has changed tremendously. Now teams do tackle issues. Teams tackle more serious storylines. And so the impact of that performance was huge. It was an honor to be a part of it. Made some lifelong friends. My senior year after winning that chip, took the year off. There were some falling out that happened because of it. Honestly, I won't go into that, but it was all's well now. So it was all fine, but I missed dance. So in 2016, when I moved to Boston for grad school, I didn't have any friends. I went from that little lake that is college and now into the Pacific Ocean, right? Yeah. In the middle of a life of pi storm, right?
Yeah.
With the huge waves and everything. And so I didn't know what I was doing. And I was kind of just like, okay, I need to cling on to something that I know I like to do. And that was dance. And so I knew that Boston University across the river had a team that I was aware of. And I was kind of a fan of their work. So I just went to their tryouts. And they immediately knew who I was because of the Anubhav year. And they're like, whoa, you're here. You know, that I did the tryout. And I had a great year with them. And that team, we got to go to national finals for the first time. That team hadn't gone in a really long time. And we had a pretty stacked lineup. And so we went, I got to compete against my old team.
Oh, wow.
Who ended up winning the chip, and I was very happy for it. It was all my friends and the ones that I had actually taken onto the team when I was part of leadership. So, you know, it was great to see them do their thing. And then I was like, okay, can I do something more professional? I joined with Rohit Gijre. I helped him create his dance company. There was like 5 or 6 of us that started Exodus Artistry, in 2016. That was good. He was always someone that I looked up to. Funny enough, he was the guy who judged my team, the competition at Bollywood America 2014. So he's the one that kind of, he's part of the reason why we got crowned champions. So I knew who he was. He didn't know who I was. We started dancing together. We really vibed and we clicked. And now he's one of my best friends. We started that company together. Through the company, I meet Akash. I was always meaning to like do my own thing, find my own voice in dance. And I always wanted to be a choreographer. More than just a dancer, you know. Yeah. I wanted to choreograph and create my own part. And I met Akash. We started dancing together. We became friends pretty instantly. I loved what Akash did in terms of African styles. And I told him, I was like, I was a very contemporary classical dancer. I was like, if you're going to train in these classes, just let me know. I'll come to these classes. I came. I was immediately hooked. I started training with him hardcore. Through him, I met Ashoka because they had danced together at Lehigh. And we started dancing together. And part of it was some of our friends, they're like a video, you know, they make some video productions and very professional work. But I am a troll to my friends. And I decided one time to film a video with Rohit and Alia while we were in Phoenix. And I filmed it for them, you know, without any tripod or anything. Yeah. And I edited it. And I did a wordplay on my friend's production company as like my post. This is my company.
Oh my God.
Here's my video production.
What happened after that?
It was meant to be a lighthearted joke. And I think everyone knew that except them. To this day, they're my amazing friends that they know. But they had an intervention with me because they were like, listen, what we do is professional and what you did was shot on a phone. So, you know, you can't create these videos and call yourself a videographer. And that wasn't my intent. But the biggest motivator in life for me is someone telling me that I can't do something, right? So they were like, you know, you can't do this. You're not a professional video, whatever, creator. I was like, okay. And I'm not a vengeful person, but if someone tells me that I can't do something, I will do it to the best of my ability. And I will learn the craft and I will become a master at it. And that's exactly what I did. And so Akash and Ashoka were not interested in creating dance videos. And I was like, you know what? I shot a video for them after one of these nights. I was like, I'm going to start an Instagram page because I shot one of their videos just for fun. And they were doing a cover. And I was like, okay, I'm going to start a whole Instagram page. I'm going to start doing series of videos from different cultures. And so this Instagram page started being created. And the first chapter was supposed to be African dance. And so I started building it up really aesthetically, did introductions of Akash, Ashoka. And I'm doing this. If you scroll all the way to the bottom of Afrodisi's Instagram, you'll see all that. And at the time, Afrodisi was called something called P3 & Co. I don't know why I called it that. You know, it was just called that because the same people that had an intervention with me, they had said, you know, you need to name it something else. And they were like, why not P3? I was like, okay, sure. You know, Pranab Patel Productions, whatever. So, and then we kind of morphed that into, we jokingly say, Patel Fulmani Punjabi for the three of us.
Yeah.
So it formed. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh yeah, this is turning into a thing. We got a really, really quick following because it was so like, I think it was because it was so aesthetic and it was so informative that people really started buying into it. We saw more success than some people that may have doubted us.
Wow.
very quickly, maybe in the first, I would say, 2 weeks, and I wasn't done yet, right? It wasn't to prove a point. There are some of my best friends. It was just a motivator, and then after that, I was like, okay, we have something here, we took one of these Afro classes, and Akash's like, let's go buy this guy a meal, Saquon Keys, a very famous African choreographer.
Yeah.
We're sitting down, and Saquon kind of talked about like how he likes Indian dance. And in that moment, the moment he mentioned that, my light bulb in my head went off, you know, huge choreographer. I want to get into choreoing myself. I'm like, Akash and I were thinking about doing a class already. We're like, why don't, you know, I'm an expert at Bollywood, self-proclaimed in this very moment. And you are clearly an expert that in African forms. Why don't we kind of merge next time you're out in New York and teach a class together? The Indian market could be huge to you. You know, I kind of threw him out, like, you know, threw some numbers at him and all that stuff and sort of wowed him. And he said, okay, you know, and he comes back a month later and we teach our first ever workshop with him. So the class is sold out, you know. That was like the best collaboration ever. Just his name alone just meant the class was just filled, which was perfect, you know. So I pulled like a little idea out of my hat. And then Akash and Ashoka were definitely down for it. And Akash had a lot to do with the planning of it. And then I think he might have come up with the name of it. We kind of just ran with it after that. But we didn't feel prepared to teach on our own. So we trained for 3 months more or 4 months more after that first class to really get me more comfortable with the style too.
Yeah.
Because I didn't feel like I could teach African dance. That's just not going to happen. And to this day, I try to leave that to Akash and I try to teach just what I know well. But yeah, that's kind of what morphed into like a dance company. Instagram handle changes to Afrodisi, you know, everything kind of changes and it sort of just takes off. I was very adamant about marketing and always doing it. The first international tour that we labeled in London, Akash and Ashoka were never on board with it. They were like, that's the worst idea. We don't know what we're doing. We have no one hosting us. I make a friend. I stay at my friend Neelam's place. I book all the places. You know, I set up ticketing. I did targeted ads on Instagram toward the London audience for a few months prior leading up to it to make sure that we had that audience, started connecting with people, started messaging people, all these dance companies, sending our flyers. And what do you know? We have an international tour, you know, and it turned out really successful. And some of my closest friends are now in London. So I think, you know, when people doubt you, I think, and back you up into a corner and you feel like you're backed up into a corner, I think it's entirely up to you on how you treat that. But one really good way to treat that is as motivation and kind of funnel all that into just, you know, being the best version of yourself and trying something new and trying to master that craft. And it's still learning. And now as we enter a new chapter, we'll see where after this goes, but it's definitely not stopping. I'm teaching a workshop for the Democrat vote in Texas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just to get some people to come out to vote. Yeah. Fundraise for that because God knows this isn't the most important election in recent world history. Yeah. Probably.
I feel like somewhere it's like the good Jew in you coming out with the whole marketing and salesy approach. Like the way that you even ran your first workshop was just like, yep, we're just going to take the audience of this person because they're really big. No, I love that. I think you're almost your biggest fan base is in London. Like literally everyone knows you here and like, you know, you've come a few times and I'd say like, especially like the Desi dance community is very aware of Afro-Desi and like always kind of rooting for you guys. I guess there's also an element of relatability, like similar age. And like, I was actually going to ask you though, do you think the UK dance scene is quite different to the US now that you've taught and you know people in both?
I think that the U.S. was probably a bit ahead in terms of workshops and teaching in terms of Bollywood dance. But honestly, I think all of this stuff really just took off in like the last few years. I mean, like Shivani and Chaya really put it up in the mainstream a few years ago with B-Funk. Yep. And people followed suit. You know, we followed suit. SA Grooves followed suit. Mm-hmm. People out west started following suit. So I think this is a very novel concept. So mm-hmm. I don't think Britain was really behind by a lot. Mm-hmm. But when we first came to London, you know, there were a few people teaching. Mm. And now, just a year later, there's a lot more people teaching. Yeah. So I think it's growing very quickly. And I think as South Asian artists see other artists teaching and being comfortable in their own craft enough to teach, they want to do it themselves. And I think that's amazing because it's a whole new form of art for us. In its own genre. So it's really cool. And I think London's really catching up. And to the support that the London community gives us, y'all are nicer.
Maybe you just don't know us,
or maybe we just don't know you, maybe, you know. But you know, from what I know, the support has been tremendous, and it's a really, really, really exciting environment for Akash to be in a few months.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think what you said about how like more and more people are teaching now, I think we are starting to go into this mindset of like, you no longer have to be classically trained since you were 5 years old in order to feel like you can teach. You know, you can just train for a few years really solidly and then start kind of running workshops. And even if they're one-off, like this whole culture of running one-off workshops is, I think, only really kicked off. I would say in London, I've definitely only seen it after B-Funk came. So, and you see like people even here, you know, who've not really taught before, they'll run like a one, you know, 2 hour thing once in a while. And, and it's just so nice because it's like, we no longer have those boundaries. We can just sort of, do whatever we want to. And if that means teaching, then like you said, it's just a matter of teaching yourself it, training in it. And I love that you guys actually took the time to train in it. Like I noticed as well with your workshop is you always go into workshop assuming it's just going to be, you're going to learn the dance, you're going to film it and you're going to go home. But actually like with you guys, I noticed that you were teaching the actual Afro moves and you were telling us the names for them. And we did like a really solid warm up. And I just thought that was so thoughtful. It actually invests you into that style as well. And so since then, I know that there's a lot more people around here who are interested in African dance because of that. So, and also I think this whole fusion culture, I think is really cool that's emerging now. I know like other dancers as well here that are doing fusion work and like kind of creating their own mixes. Actually, tell me about your mixes. Do you create them yourselves?
No. We have a few DJs that we work with closely, namely DJ Sudi, based out of the US, DJ Modi, based out of Tanzania. Shreemix has done a few of our mixes, and these are just to name a few. So yeah, we have multiple DJs, and sometimes people create these fusion mixes. So with Afro-Desi also, it just doesn't yield a new form of dance, but it also yields a new form of music, right? Because it just doesn't exist, that fusion.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool, right? All of our mixes are something, they have a sound that not many people are used to, with a different backbeat and different lyrics. So, and the possibilities of combining them are endless. And to your point about combining and fusion culture, I think I do like fusion culture, but even as a competition judge, a lot of times, or as a mentor for a lot of the teams here, I always err on the side of caution with them. And I tell them to think about what they're borrowing from, what culture they're borrowing from, and being completely honest with themselves on what their expertise is and what their capacity is to teach it.
Yeah.
I think we always reevaluate that with ourselves and make sure that like we are correctly paying homage to the styles that we're borrowing from and informing our audience of where we're borrowing them. And we don't present ourselves as a leading authority. We say, okay, we've trained and this is how much we know, but this is kind of a surface level intro into this style. And if you want to learn more, it's not by going to all of our workshops, it's to, and then we will always give lists of people that people should train with because we train with them, you know, and we're constantly training. And I think that's the right approach as a choreographer, not always just being so comfortable with your skill set and claiming your own, you know, being so proud that you can see ways to improve yourself, and to always pay proper homage to where you're borrowing from.
Yeah.
That's critically important, you know, especially for your audience to know. So that's kind of the approach towards fusion. Same goes for music and stuff like that. And if you do that, then I think people respect your work a little bit more, and they feel like they, to your point, can walk away from class feeling that they learned something more than just a sequence of steps. They learned something.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really powerful.
Yeah. So just in terms of your social media, so when Afro Desi kind of kicked off, I know like I definitely started following you guys like around like maybe a few months into your first few workshops. And I did notice you were getting a lot of female attention. Is that something that you would say like you got after Afro Desi kicked off?
Yeah, definitely. And I think so. Akash Ashok and I are all logged into our account. And the one rule is I will always respond to every single DM.
Yeah.
So, you know, if someone messages, you know, even if it's flirtatious or whatever it is, you always respond, and you respond in a respectful way. And I think it's been great. Honestly, I think people have also been very respectful for us. I think people kind of approach you the way you approach them and the way you treat them. And I feel like we come off, we try to keep it as professional as we can. And so I think that also morphs into other people treating us with professionalism to some degree, you know, not being, you know, as nonchalant as they could be in their interactions with us, which is nice. And I think there's always a way to redirect attention into like just positive like guidance, and support is support.
That is such a busy answer. And I can see your eyes like shifting sideways while you're telling me. No, I'm kidding. But okay, if you don't mind me asking though, what is like the weirdest DM you've got?
Oh man, there's definitely been like some marriage proposal type stuff. There's definitely been like very, very like direct questions about like our lives that are definitely too invasive. And they're just like very, very upfront about it, you know? There's people that will definitely be like, you know, I'd pick Akash, my sister would pick, you know, Pranav, and my cousin will pick Ashoka, and like, we'll have a great time together.
That's oh my God. Do you have a fight over who gets more attention? Is there one person who gets more attention than the other two?
I don't think so, necessarily. I think that Akash and I definitely get a little bit more attention. That's not because of any of our personalities or even who we are. I think we just teach a lot more. Mm. So we're just all over the media.
Yeah.
You know, like we just teach a lot more together. So people see us kind of together traveling around.
Yeah.
And I think that'll change now, because I think Ashok is coming to the United States.
Okay.
He's trying to come back. And so now it'll just be like, I swapped Akash out of my life for Ashoka for a little bit. So it's going to be interesting. But no, I don't think we really compete over attention, namely because, I mean, Akash and I are in relationships and Ashoka isn't. But I think Ashoka is content with his life. So I don't think that, you know, he's seeking any sort of...
I felt the obligation to ask this question. And also, so now that you've actually mentioned that you're going to be in different countries and Akash is coming to London, allegedly. So we've basically adopted him now. But how are things going to work with you guys being in different countries? Like, are you going to continue teaching in person? What's the future like for Afro Desi?
The future involves a lot of trips to London for me.
Love it.
To be honest, because I love going there, right? Even after that summer tour last year, I came back in November just on my own, right? To do my own little tour because I was on break. I was like, hey, I'll just go to London and do it solo. So I love being out there. And as soon as Akash lands in London, I know I'm going to be there to kind of help him move and settle in, and also to teach some workshops. We're kind of itching to teach right now, you know, because of COVID, we just haven't gotten to. So we do a lot of, all three of us teach like solo workshops pretty much, on Zoom. But yeah, we're excited to go back in person, and it's definitely going to happen in person. Akash can definitely visit the States. So we'll definitely hit the Gold Coast soon. We're just kind of sad we didn't get to do a farewell workshop in New York person. That would have been really nice to do. So we'll try to make that happen. But yeah, in person is definitely going to be the move. I think Akash will definitely be teaching more in person, obviously, mm-hmm. than just when I'm there in London. So London will now have more regularity when it comes to Afro-DSC. So that's going to be great. And I think that the London African dance scene is fantastic.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. It's so good. It's so raw. I mean, so many good choreographers that we look up to, that we've trained with while we were in London, the limited time that we've had. So I know that Akash is going to be working with them. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some really fun collaborations that are going to come out of this. Like, I could definitely see an Afro-DSC in a Patience class. You know,
I love Patience. I've been to classes this year as well. She's just on such a different level. It's just, yeah, it's incredible.
It's awesome. And she's so, she's so friendly, so respectful, so nice to talk to, so willing to, respect our work, which was amazing, you know? So I definitely think there's some really, really cool collaborations coming from the London community. So I'm excited for that chapter, the whole London chapter, the New York chapter comes to a close. And Ashok and I will hold it down in the United States as soon as he gets here. And in the meantime, I'll probably do some traveling and teaching as soon as travel permits. So I don't think after this is over, I'm never gonna sit back and say, okay, we did it. You know, I'm never gonna let dance go in my life.
I also feel you hold so much pride with just the way you started after this to prove a point. So if you finished it, it would be like, oh, he failed, didn't he?
Exactly. And the success has been great. It's been stalled a little bit recently just because of COVID and because of all of our life's occurrences. So we haven't been able to post a lot of content, but we've been teaching a lot. Mm. We just haven't been posting those class videos. Chapter is exciting. I mean, now we're officially in three countries, you know, and three the most prominent Indian populated countries in the world, in India, United States, and the UK. So the possibilities are endless. And this three-headed monster that we have, it's really cool.
Yeah, I think you're heading towards world domination soon, definitely. All right. Well, moving on to, I think, the last part, which is, you and I had a conversation during lockdown about the Black Lives Matter movement and the anti-racism talks and everything that's happening. You've actually been quite vocal about your opinions around it as well on your social media. How did that impact you as a person? And what sort of work have you done offline, maybe on the side, to support this movement?
You know, this movement is an interesting product of a lot of things, right? What's enabled sort of Black Lives Matter to really kind of come in stride. And it's a part of a pandemic. You know, obviously the two incidences that happened in Central Park and with George Floyd, and the numerous instances that have happened since, all the way to the Kenosha shooting of Jacob Blake. But honestly, I didn't pay much attention, you know, to police brutality before these instances. I would look at the instances and I would get a little annoyed, you know, but the heaviness of it didn't really occur to me. And I think that holds true for a lot of people, even if they feel like, you know, if they show externally that they've cared about this their whole lives. I think that for a large majority of the population, this is something that has now come to our attention. Really, the gravity of it has come to our attention very recently. So with that being said, I remember when the first protest started happening and I was talking to my family and, you know, Indian parents can always be a little bit, you know, anti-Black in some regard and just be like, you know, don't associate too much. You know, you could put yourself in danger, all this stuff, the stereotyping that happens. And so I'm like talking to my parents because I'm just like, you know, trying to further the conversation, trying to make the sense of these sort of horrible videos. And I remember sitting with my dad, who reads the news avidly, and always has, sits me down and he walks me through and he remembers every single victim, starting from the very first victim that was ever caught on camera to now. So he names me all the occurrences of police brutality that have all been caught. And I look up each one as he's telling me and I read on them.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember kind of hearing about them as a kid, but not really understanding it. My dad knows all of them. He says, son, this has been a problem for a really, really long time. And media attention and social media has allowed this to kind of really permeate society, but it's just been there in the background. And as I read more, I learned more, and I realized how much not only it impacted society, but it also impacted my dad and the way he kind of, he takes it to heart too when he sees instances like this. And it really, that sort of kind of moved me into doing something about it, I think, ultimately, because you realize America has had a really long history of it. And if you look at the way society has progressed, if you look at the way the LGBT community has now been accepted in life, and just like into society, into normalcy, into some form of it in the last 15 years, it's been exponential, right? How much they've been accepted. Or if you talk about women's rights and gender pay, of course, there's ways to go in all of these sort of issues of equality. But the growth has been just exponential. In one generation, we've seen so many female CEOs, and there's a positive way to look at it, right? There's the positive way to look at it is to say progress is happening. And then you move to racism, and you move to what is seemingly the simplest, most fundamental value to understand in the world, and that is equality between humans, you know? And when that is not understood by society, it makes you question, you know, morality, it makes you question humanity, it makes you question the good in people, it may even form your own biases towards certain communities, for instance, the white community, if you're part of a minority. So it's amazing how slow racism is being eradicated in this country, if at all, and how much it's being enabled. So do things about it. I feel like the onus is on our generation, you know, to do something about it. If you talk to, you know, Indian parents, might have been like, yeah, well, it happens all the time. Well, the question is, you know, what happened? What would you do in the same instance of George Floyd was Raj Kumar, right? Like, what would you do? How would you have reacted? You saw an elderly, middle-aged elderly man being suffocated. Now, what would you do? Would you be sitting at home making like rotis for the next meal, or would you literally be at an Indian protest or at a samaj or in your community advocating for this man and protesting, right? And so that contextual, when something is about yourself, you want to do something about it. But when it comes to this fundamental value of equality, and the world doesn't seem to care. I mean, what happened? We just started going back to normalcy. Black Lives Matter seemed to lose some steam, right, on all of our media. Yeah. We saw it. People started moving back to normalcy. And then, boom, Kenosha hits again. And really, people don't really talk about it. I didn't see the shooting being talked about on my media too much. I really didn't. And so I felt compelled 2 days ago to be like, wait a minute. Friendly reminder, this is one of the worst things that's happened this year. And, like, we're not talking about it because now we're all at school and now we're all working. And, you know, so it gets so lost so quickly. And we're so far from the fight being over. I mean, you look at the NBA players, they simply didn't know what to do. They felt so marginalized that they said, we just can't play for your entertainment. We're not going to play. We're just going to boycott. We can't do it. They considered ending the season. They put their livelihoods on the line. They knew they would lose hundreds of thousands of dollars or even millions. And they were willing to do that because they were like, this is what I need to do to make the world pay attention to this ongoing issue. And the problem with the states is that this, to what I'm doing about it, the states, in the states, because of the 10th Amendment, you have police powers, which have been afforded to the states by our Constitution, which means the federal government, you know, President Trump, no matter what he says, or whoever is in office, can't really dictate what police do. Police are regulated on the local city, state, you know, county levels. So that being said, your president or your federal government is not going to be able to just have this blanket policy that says all police officers need to be trained on racism.
Yeah.
You know, that's not going to happen. So what's going to have to happen is you need to know about your local government officials, see what their policy stances are on things like the police union, write to them, talk to them. So yes, I've signed the petitions and whatever. But I think more so than that, it's knowing who you're voting for. Voting, as a lot of people are saying, exercising your right, but not just for the president, voting for each of the local government officials, writing to them. I wrote a lot of letters to, I remember when George Floyd happened, I wrote a lot of letters to like state legislatures and members of my state and in Florida, and just being part of them and just being like, look, you need to do something. And this is why. And I think that the more, you know, even if they don't read it, it's a numbers game and it sort of floods them into knowing what the people want. And I think that that's where power comes from. And so hopefully that will bring about change. And I think that's what it's about. I think this election is the most important election probably in American history, because we were seemingly at a turning point. Sorry for talking so long, but yeah, I mean, that's just how I feel about it. And that's what I feel everyone should try to do on it and continue to have the hard discussions. As a final note, I mean, I watched all these videos. You know, a lot of times you don't want to watch these videos because they're so gruesome. You're like, oh God, you know, it's just going to ruin my mood. No, you have to watch them, right? Because when you watch them and you watch them over and over again, and you let it sink in, like the guy, you know, Blake's kids were in the car, and you let yourself understand the gravity of that situation, and you watch it, and these are difficult things to watch. You now understand what they're going through more, and you really start seeing it. So if you watch the 8 minutes and 46 seconds that George Floyd is getting suffocated, you understand how gruesome that situation is, you know, and you have to watch those things. It's on you to watch those things, even if it's hard to watch, so that you really understand the kind of gravity of it. So yeah, I mean, those are just my 2 cents.
No, I completely, it makes so much sense though, because it's like, we've seen what happened with, you know, when you said Black Lives Matter is sort of like losing steam. It's no longer really prevalent on social media in the same way anymore. So now with this more recent incident, like, I just think there's not as much traction, because it's almost like, oh, we've done Black Lives Matter. Like, we did that a few months ago. It's over, kind of thing. And it's like, no, it's not. It is a lifetime, you know, change that you need to make in your personal life. And you also need to do whatever you can in your power to be anti-racist. I think, we've kind of rambled on for like ages now. So I'm just going to ask you a final question, Pranab. What do you have a strong game in?
Strong game. I think the word is finesse. So I think that my finesse game is strong. That word means a lot to me, because it just means making the most of the opportunities that you have, and making more of them than they seem to be, I think is also good, because the more you own them and the more you're proud of them, the more other people want to work with you, the more other opportunities open up for you. But doing so in the correct way and still putting your all into each of those opportunities.
Absolutely. And what's one thing that you could be stronger in, maybe?
Definitely, it's not doing everything myself. I'm a person who loves to do everything myself. And the more you connect with really amazing people, the more you communicate with them, the more you learn that, you know, a lot of people have some really good things to offer and they can help you out in life. And a lot of times I'm like closed off to them and I'm like, no, I'll do it my way, because I think I know best. And I think being more open-minded, let's say that, being more open-minded is definitely something that I can be in my life. And it's something that I continuously work on.
Yeah. Would you like to share your social media handles for people to follow you on?
Sure. My social media is pranabpatel.jpg, like the picture format.
Why is that? I've always wondered that.
There's just too many Pranab Patels in the world, and I don't like numbers in my usernames. So I like it to look clean, and P. Patel or every variation of that, P.S. Patel, doesn't work for me. So, you know, I had to do it that way. I used to be P squared when I was a kid on Instagram.
Like the artist.
Like the artist, yes. But that was because of Pranab Patel, so I was P squared, you know, little math joke. Afro-Desi, except the E is a 3. But if you just type in Afro-Desi, it probably is the first thing to come up. But yeah, that's my social media channel. And I'm just, you know, for those of you listening in London, I'm so excited to be back there. It's one of my favorite places to be. I will be there, I would say, within 2 months or just a little bit over 2 months. And I'm going to stay there for quite a bit. So I'm going to be happy to be there, happy to meet all of you. Definitely drop on by in workshops and all of that. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Mithali, for having me on the podcast. It's been awesome chatting with you. And now I feel like I know you a lot more. I feel like you know me a lot more than I know you. So I think that if we need to switch the tables at some point, I can learn more about you. And if it's someone else interviewing me, then I'll be listening so that so that I can get to know you a lot more.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we look forward to having you in London. And yeah, I will ramble on about my life for ages when you do come. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. Like, really appreciate it.
This has been really interesting. And with the headset on, I feel like I'm on the radio.
Yeah, so you definitely look more professional than I do right now. But I think, yeah, hopefully the first of many, and looking forward to what you guys do with Afrodisi. And yeah, just looking forward to learning more from you guys as well.
Yeah, thanks.